what I want to do today is share with you some the latest findings, well, some old and some very new, not yet published, but in press findings from what's called the NICHD Study of Early Child Care, and actually it's now the NICHD Study of Early Child Care and Youth Development. This NICHD stands for the American Funding Body, part of the National Institute of Health, NIH, specifically the National Institute of Child Health and Human Development. And this is a study, as you'll see, in which we enrolled some 1,364 firstborn children and their families from basically the time of birth. And as we speak, they are now being studied at age 15. So I won't be able to tell you about that, about them. This is a study of which I am one of a laundry list of collaborating investigators. In the interests of being frank and forthcoming, let me make this perfectly clear. Everything I say today about the study in terms of its design, methods, and results will be factual and endorsed and, in fact, published and thus endorsed by this entire group of people with greater and lesser enthusiasm, I can add. But having said that, and this is very clear, the presentation itself will be framed in my voice. So what I want to make clear is what all too often isn't made clear in newspapers, which is the news is not just the news. The editor chooses what news goes on the front page, what news goes on the back page, and what headlines go to what stories. All right? And so it's eminently conceivable. In fact, I bet dollars to donuts on it, that if you had invited at least some of my colleagues, you would hear a very different talk, because they would have spun it a different way. They would have selected different issues and findings and methods to highlight. So that's my way of sort of being frank and open at the start. Now, the NICHD study of early child care was born in controversy. As it turned out, it was a controversy of my inadvertent making. I wrote a paper in 1978 with the late, and I would say great, Uri Bronfenbrenner, my mentor at Cornell University, that reviewed the then research on the effects of child care. It was a report commissioned by the United States federal government, and we basically came to the conclusion that despite lots of claims about adverse or deleterious or worse effects of child care on children's development, that the research base to substantiate those claims was simply not there. Now, that was taken by many in the field and the policy world and private citizens as a green light, which said daycare is okay. What wasn't read carefully was that we said that those claims of adverse effects could not be substantiated basically because of limitations to the research. Now, what's very interesting is when research is limited, but its findings are in your favor, so to speak, the limits tend to get downplayed. When research is just as limited, but the findings go against what might be your predilections, all of a sudden those limitations get accentuated. So buyer beware in listening to anybody about, you know, where their take on the research is coming from. And we pointed out that there were a number of unanswered questions at the time having to do with the fact that most studies 30 years ago were focused on high-quality, university-based programs set up to enroll children so that they can be studied, i.e. for research purposes, and thus what those studies could actually tell you about child care in the everyday communities around the United States or anywhere else was potentially, if not necessarily, limited. Secondly, we didn't know enough about variations in quality of care, that is, how attentive, responsive, and stimulating caregivers were, and the extent to which that might make a difference in how child care affected children, though there was more than enough reason to suspect that it would matter. Thirdly, we didn't know virtually anything about timing or age of entry into care, whether starting earlier or later had better or worse consequences. And relatedly, we knew virtually nothing about amount or dosage of care and its impact on children. Ultimately, while you could think of the effects of daycare as a complex design equation, most of the variables, most of the parameters, most of the considerations had simply not been investigated. 8 years down the road in 1986, I published an essay which turned out to be kind of, at least in the field of developmental sciences and not psychology more generally, what might go by the name of the shot heard round the world. Because I basically called attention to what were, let me quote myself here, a slow, steady trickle of disconcerting evidence. Because I called attention to evidence that suggested that lots of time spent in infant daycare beginning in the first year of life looked like it was related to elevated rates of insecure infant mother attachment bonds, and at later ages to elevated levels of aggression and disobedience. And I suggested that these two different consequences look like consequences, one on infants and one on older children, may actually be part of a developmental process, with childcare promoting insecurity and thereby later aggression and disobedience. I called my argument an inference. I said it was based on circumstantial evidence. And I not only said that, I said others could, would, and should disagree with me. Well, that was an understatement with regard to what would happen. It remains the case today that one of the reasons I work in London is because I can't be hired in America. I appreciate the fact that I ran into the wall of political correctness before the term was even coined. So what I pointed out was, and the response back to me was incredible. On the one hand, there was a legitimate intellectual critique, which I anticipated and welcomed, which said, hey, the data are limited. This is circumstantial evidence. I said the same thing. And most importantly, people argued, not unreasonably, was that, oh, the only thing that matters is its quality. And that's why I quote Bill Clinton here with a little modification taken. It's quality, stupid. That is, if the quality of care was good, nothing else mattered. It was as if, well, there are lots of parameters in this daycare equation. The quality of care is certainly one. The age you started, the amount of time you had in care, the kind of care you got. Was it a center? Was it a family daycare home? Was it a nanny? The mantra within the developmental community was, and almost still remains to this day, it's quality, quality, quality. It's kind of like it's the favorite variable. It's the only thing that matters. It's like the argument that goes along with divorce. As long as it sort of lessens conflict, it's perfect. It's wonderful. The idea that, you know, marriage as an institution, as a definition, might carry some impact in and of itself, by itself, perhaps through some not well understood means, was simply not acceptable. Well, one of the great things about this controversy, and, you know, I sometimes think that I'm like a piece of Swiss cheese. I have so many holes in me. In fact, I ran into Sarah McClanahan, whose work Elizabeth cited, who was one of the first to point out, you know, that, you know, they looked like there were liabilities associated with single parenthood, as somebody who came to the problem, actually like I did, with, if anything, ideological biases in the opposite direction, but couldn't, you know, avoid, dismiss, or deny the data. I said to her, gee, I'm surprised that you don't look like a piece of Swiss cheese too, because she also went through the same kind of shoot the messenger experience. And in fact, let me say something in that regard very clearly here. I had somebody come up to me earlier and said, you know, that I really appreciate the work you've done. You've been really important in supporting we stay-at-home mothers, and as we go through this, you'll see why somebody looks at me that way. And I'm sure I was invited here, as I know I've been invited elsewhere, because people often project a certain set of values and political orientation onto me. I know my intellectual adversaries do. You know, they'd be shocked, they'd be horrified, they'd be amazed to learn that the fact is I've never voted Republican in my life. But they may come though. Don't get me wrong. It's not sort of it's not a, you know, party line issue. It's an issue of, you know, what are the alternatives specifically at that point in time. But the point I want to make here is I think we all too often confuse in policy circles and science circles and lay circles with findings with ideologies and beliefs. And it's taken me years to come up with a formulation to get this across to journalists very clearly. That, because they always get on the phone and they say, oh, so you're against daycare. And I go through this long-winded argument. I'm not for or against daycare. I'm an empiricist. I do behavioral science research. This is a problem of our time, an intellectual topic of our time. And so I'm studying it. If I find this, I tell you it. If I find that, I tell you it. And the way I come to look at it is this way. If the weatherman tells you it's going to be rain tomorrow, it's not because he's against sunshine. Okay? By the same token, if I tell you then 20 years ago or now or whatever that there are developmental risks associated with daycare, it's not because I'm against daycare, and it's not because I am or I'm not one of you. So please don't confuse the science with the values. They're separate things, and I think all too often they get confused. And they lead, and I'm a great believer that in the final analysis, I'll say at the end, I hope, if I leave myself enough time, that the world of policy, that evidence isn't the only factor that goes into policy. It should be one of them. But certainly values matter a lot. So there's no such thing as this evidence leads inevitably to this policy implication. God knows we have plenty of evidence that says that smoking contributes and causes, in some cases, cancer and a whole host of diseases. But we let people smoke. Why? Because we value freedom. There's not a one-to-one correspondence between a piece of evidence and a policy. There's a processing mind, yours, mine, anybody else's, who can take that. So if I say something about our findings, that doesn't mean I'm with you or against you. It means this is what we found. We live in an open society which lets us process that information as we see fit. Some people who are advocates selectively attend to only what's consistent with what they already believe and what they want to advocate for, and we allow that. As an open-minded empiricist, that's not the way I play the game. To me, it's sort of whatever the data says, good, bad, or indifferent, consistent or inconsistent with what I might like or dislike, what I might believe or otherwise. Ultimately, there are a series of problems with prior research. The first is something that that our first speaker mentioned this morning, which is about issues of selection, which is that how do we know that in this case, daycare, or in that case, marriage, or is really causing a good thing or a bad thing? It may be that people who use daycare, more or less, better or worse, earlier or later in the child's life, would generate those consequences anyway. This is what we call the third variable problem. That is, while it looks like we have a correlation between some child care experience and some developmental outcome, it could be a function of a third variable, and until we discount those things and take them into control and adjust for them, we won't know for sure. And that was the limit of the first of the early studies. Secondly, in many of these studies, the people who pointed out that it's quality stupid, that the only thing that matters is quality, and if quality is good, everything will be wonderful for children, rightly observed that, as I did myself, that many of the studies lacked information on quality. What they never pointed out was that many of the studies that looked at quality and its beneficial effects entirely lacked information on when children started childcare or how much childcare children had. Because to them, those variables didn't need to be considered. Those factors weren't fundamentally ideologically important to them. So they ignored them. And what I've always objected to is an uneven scientific and even logical playing field. If you're going to criticize work because it lacks something, you have to turn that methodological critical mind flashlight onto other work, that even if you like it, say it lacks something too. Now we're dealing, because then we're dealing with open-minded information, and we can then process it fairly. There were also concerns about the way in which attachment security and specifically insecurity was measured, and that it could have been, that findings suggesting elevated rates of insecurity could have been a methodological artifact, not a true effect of childcare. I probably don't have time to get into that scientific detail. And finally, there was a suggestion that these kids who use SAJ, and it wasn't me, it was the evidence I was calling attention to, none of this was my research, that you say these kids look more aggressive because that's what the scores they get in studies of aggression in child care, that there's a mistake here, and people are confusing independence and assertiveness with aggression. So these kids aren't more aggressive, they're more independent and assertive. So this controversy, and it was a big controversy, I had my picture in Time magazine, we had stories in New York Times, I once was in a conference, and there were at least 800 people in the building, and I had this premonition that somebody was going to walk down the aisle and shoot me. It was kind of like a Malcolm X moment. And that's just the matter. I just say that not because I'm a lunatic, although some people might think I am, but more to say how crazy the whole world got, at least for me. But the good news about this war, what somebody called in a book in 1994, the Daycare Wars, was that it generated intellectual interest in the problem, and the NICHD funding agency said, we should study this. Now, they never expected that over the course of what is now about 18 years of funded work, actually 17, they would spend in excess of $150 million. But that's what they've come to spend on this work, and you'll see why as I go through it. Because it was elaborate and it overcame virtually all the limitations of previous work. And in fact, I even go so far as to say, The moral story here is if you want to raise money for a subject matter, and maybe, Elizabeth, this is the way to do it, generate a controversy. You know, if I can take... What?
I hate you.
Yeah, I know. Well, I mean, you got to be willing to be Swiss cheese. It's like on the one hand, you line up the Olivias of the world. On the other hand, you line up the opposite. And, you know, if they're prepared to participate, or at least the academics who study these things are, all of a sudden people realize that there's an interesting question here. And so I think there's like a case study in raising money for an issue here. Now, in the NICHD study, we went around and we recruited about 120 children from 10 different areas. And this wasn't a great way to do this work, but hindsight's always 20/20, because these areas where we did this work in small university towns like Madison, Wisconsin, and Charlottesville, Virginia, or state capitals like Madison, or Little Rock, Arkansas, or places like Pittsburgh and Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, were not selected from some strategic sampling standpoint to get a nationally representative sample. It's where the win is of the competition to do the research came from. So if all the winners for the competition had come from Southern California, and as you see, only one did, all the work would have been done down there. Actually, there should be a dot up there in Seattle, too, because there's a site there. So this isn't a nationally representative sample, but it is a diverse sample. And this is where some of the families have already spread through from those 10 sites. And there you can see we do have Seattle represented. Okay, so through the age of 12, we had followed up about, been able to maintain contact with and study almost 1,100 of these original 1,364 children. This is what we call a normative longitudinal sample. By that, I mean, we didn't manipulate anything on these children. We just went into their lives and studied them wherever they were. And this is one of the big differences in our study, which is wherever those children's child care arrangements were, and they changed over time, we followed them there. It wasn't like we went to a child care center here and a child care center there and recruited children from child care centers. We recruited children and families from hospitals where the children were born. As I said, the families were diverse. Now, this shows one of the reasons why this is such an expensive study. And in fact, this is grade 3. We also studied the children in grade 4, 5, and 6. And what's most expensive about this study was that we studied the children in their homes. We went into the families. We interviewed parents. We observed and videotaped parents interacting with their children. We do that repeatedly over time. We went in their child care settings if they were in child care. Some children weren't in child care. But we define child care as any non-maternal care arrangement. So if you were actually a father staying home caring for your children, we qualified that as non-maternal care, and we studied that. When kids were 6, 15, 24, 36, and 54 months of age, we went into those settings twice on two separate days for 4 hours each day and observed those children there. We then followed the same model when children entered school. So they were in actually grade 1, grade 3, and grade 5. We went in and did observations in their classroom. So this has actually become a study. We have some papers on it on schooling effects. And finally, we brought the children into the laboratory repeatedly over time so that we could do some standardized assessments of them under control conditions, as well as get teacher reports and parent reports on their social functioning. Okay, because of the issue of selection, we measured lots of features of the home family context, including basic demographic factors, the quality of home experience, including how they were parented. We observed how mothers and fathers behaved toward children. We measured characteristics of parents, their ages, their incomes, their educations. Were they depressed? And as I said, parent-child interaction. Most importantly, perhaps, when it came to the alternative care arrangement, we wanted fundamentally to be able to get beyond the issue of, is child care good or bad for children? Does child care have beneficial or detrimental effects on children? We wanted to unpack the black box and appreciate the complexity of the child care equation. And we did that first by measuring the quality of care, by going in and observing repeatedly how attentive, responsive, and stimulating were the caregivers taking care of the child, whoever that caregiver was. It was a nanny in the home, it was a childminder, a family daycare worker in our home, it was a child in the daycare center. We also wanted to measure the quantity or the dosage of care. On an average week, how much time did the child spend in routinely scheduled non-maternal care? And that varied, and it went up and down over time for children. And we also ultimately wanted to look at the type of care. Was it center-based care? Was it family day care? Was it more relative care or nanny care? This just gives you a sense of the amount of time that children spent in childcare over their first 54 months of life. The red line indicates you're in care at least 10 hours a week. The green line indicates you're in care for 30 or more hours a week. What is strikingly interesting here is that by 6 months of age, you've got kids averaging 50% of them averaging 30 or more hours of care a week. In fact, what these data actually show is, and it's what's taken place in America over the last 25 years, how much things have changed. When I was a child, people used nurseries and preschools. What qualifies for us these days is childcare, because childcare is a grab bag term for us. It incorporates all kinds of non-maternal care. When I was a child growing up in the 1950s, mothers went to work. I mean, first of all, we're talking about mothers who had choices here, not desperately poor women who had to be the wage earner, okay? Mothers went to work, but they went to work when their kids started school. 10, 15 years later, mothers went to work when their kids started preschool, maybe when they were four. Well, you know, what's changed in America, therefore, is the timing of mothers' return to work after they have a baby. Because it's gone from when the kids started school to when they were four to when they were three to now, as we see, to when they're under 6 months of age. Because the percentage of mothers in the workforce with a child under 1 year of age is like that little different from the percentage of the mothers in the workforce with their children under 5 years of age. So if you're going to go back to work after you have a baby, the odds are you're going to do it before your baby turns 6 months. And the people who are working when their children are four have been back to work since their mothers were 6 months. So it's really changed. The revolution has been the timing of mothers' return to work. And that's what these data show. Because after about 12 months of age, those lines, they're growing a little bit. They're mostly flattening out. All the entry into childcare, principally as a function of maternal employment, is going on in the first year of life. 90% of it, anyway. Okay. I want to start here by looking at the first issue, was the effects of early child care on attachment security. There are people who say that, in fact, I was reading a piece by one of my colleagues just the other day who wrote, there were no effects of child care on child on infant-mother attachment security. Remember, this is the first observation I made that people were very critical. There seemed to be an association between spending more time, and I said 20 or more hours a week in child care, beginning in the first year of life, and elevated rates of infant mother attachment insecurity. And then people say, we didn't find this. Because in some ways we didn't. That is, if I just knew how much time you spent in care, I couldn't predict your attachment security. If I just knew whether you were in good or bad quality care, I couldn't predict your attachment security. If I just knew what kind of care you were in, I couldn't predict your attachment insecurity.
Can you define attachment security?
Okay, attachment security reflects the extent to which the child has confidence and faith in the emotional availability of the caregiver. And it's measured through a procedure called the strained situation, which has been well validated and has to do with separating the baby from the mother repeatedly, but two times, over the course of a 20-minute episode and watching how the baby's emotional reaction. And we should not mistake getting upset or getting distressed with being insecure. That's not what it's about. But the time really isn't here right now to go into that. What we found was that while quantity of care or quality of care or type of care, and here's the key phrase, in and of themselves didn't tell us anything about attachment insecurity, we found that insecure attachment increased when low levels of sensitive mothering, which is the most important determinant of insecurity. Mothers who are sensitive and attentive and skilled in caring for their babies are more likely to have secure babies. Mothers who are insensitive are more likely to have insecure babies. There's both correlational and experimental evidence that shows that. But so if you were low in insecure, if you were low on sensitivity, your kid was more likely to be insecure. But that was especially likely if he had more than 10 hours a week of care over the first 15 months of life, or if he had low-quality care, or if he had more than one arrangement over the first 15 months of life. And so we drew the same conclusion, actually, that I drew in 1986 and often just about got my head cut off, that we had a dual risk here, that when you took, if you would, a vulnerable condition, insensitive mothering, which fostered insecurity, the effect of that of that vulnerable condition was amplified by any one of these. Now, what you have to appreciate is that most kids had more than one arrangement if they were in child care. Most kids in child care had more than 10 hours a week of care, although most kids didn't have low quality care. So there was a relationship, in other words, that you could say that more than 10 hours a week in child care, low quality child care, and more than one arrangement over your first 15 months of life was a risk factor in fostering insecurity. And that risk factor was realized when it coincided with low levels of sensitive mothering. It's just like saying smoking is a risk factor for heart disease, especially when it's associated with being overweight, having a history of heart disease in the family, and those kinds of things. The difference is in smoking and cancer or heart disease, we know the causal etiology at the microbiological level. I couldn't tell you that here. Yeah.
What's an arrangement, please?
I'm sorry. An arrangement would be like when you're 3 months of age, you go to the nanny. The nanny comes and takes care of you. When you were 6 months, the nanny left, I got another nanny. When you were 9 months, I took you to the neighbor's house, okay? So, and a lot of kids have multiple arrangements. So that even at 6 months, you're spending Monday, Wednesday, and Friday with your grandmother, but Tuesday and Thursday, you're at the neighbor. So that would be two arrangements. Okay, yes?
What percentage of mothers are found to have low levels of sensitive mothering?
Excellent question. In our sample, it was a third, because we just split it as a high, medium, and low. Now, the interesting thing is, and I didn't make this clear at the outset, is that we excluded certain populations from our sampling that were probably more likely to be in a low level of sensitivity, i.e. teen mothers, mothers who lived in dangerous neighborhoods that we wouldn't go into, kind of thing, for fear for our data collectors. And of course, everybody who participated was a volunteer. So there were lots of people who said, no, I'm not going to participate. So in that sense, I think there are grounds, and I'm the only one of my colleagues who will talk about it, who think that actually our low levels of sensitivity didn't represent the bottom third of, if you would, the mothering distribution. It probably represented more than that. But it's only in our sample it was the bottom third. But that's a speculation. Okay, now the interesting thing is, there were many of my colleagues who said, when we started this work, we don't care what that work shows about attachment insecurity, either the work we were doing or work that had been done. Because they said, that's a bankrupt methodology. Separating mothers from their babies in this strange situation over a 20-minute period, comings and goings, etc., that's such a non-maternal, artificial situation that it can't tell us anything. Well, first of all, and in fact, in my first paper that I referred to, we made that argument. And we argued that the strange situation was ecologically invalid. It's a brain-dead argument. My mentor misled me, Yuri Grafenberger, who I love dearly. And I'll tell you why it's a brain-dead argument. With the ecological validity, if I told you, and you weren't from the modern world, that I could put a glass pipette in your mouth, and inside that glass pipette, it had some mercury, and I could determine, you know, whether you were sick or not, you tell me, that's crazy, that's magical, that's silly. Where's the ecological validity in a thermometer? The fact that something doesn't look like it will measure what you claim it measures does not mean it doesn't measure that. Whether it measures it or not is an empirical, testable proposition. And the strange situation is a tried and true measurement procedure that, however ridiculous it may look on its face, it works. In studying a lot of things other than daycare. But nevertheless, my colleague said, we don't buy it, that's nonsense. If you want to study and understand the effects of child care and mother-child relationships, just look at how they interact. So we, who were in favor of using the strange situation to study the question of daycare and attachment security, said, sure, absolutely, why not? And in fact, that's where the measure of mother sensitivity came from, because when children were 6, 15, 24, 36, and 54 months of age, we videotape mothers interacting with their babies in situations that were either not at all or modestly stressful. And we also went into the homes and observed them there. What did we find? The more time children were in care across their first 2 and 3 years of life, the less sensitive was mothering at 6, 15, 24, and 36 months. And as a result, the less harmonious mother-child interaction patterns. and more time in care across the first 54 months of life predicted less sensitive mothering through first grade, age 6, but only for white children. In other words, forget the strange situation, you're getting even a stronger picture here that lots of time in child care, a measure of quantity, remember it's just quality, stupid, not quality, quantity here, is more time you spend in child care, the less sensitive mothers are, and the less harmony there is in that parent-child relationship. Now, I don't want to leave you with the impression that we're talking about, you know, basket case mothers and highly conflicted relationships. These are subtle effects, but they're there, when they're exactly what people said would not be there. We also found that lower quality of care, separate from amount of time in care, predicted less sensitive mothering through 36 months, but after that age, those effects didn't continue. So it was only amount of time in care that continued to affect the developing mother-infant-child relationship as measured by the procedure my colleague said we should use. So here we have, now, I haven't made this clear, and I need to. All the effects I will be talking about emerge after you've taken into consideration a laundry list of selection effects, of confounding factors. We're not only looking at daycare effects after you control for obvious suspects, like income and parents' education, but we're controlling for whether or not mothers are more versus less depressed. We're controlling in, not in these analyses, but in all the other analyses, how sensitive mothers were. So we're taking into consideration a lot of confounding factors. And we're even, when we look at the effects of amount of time in care, controlling for and taking consideration quality of care. When we're looking at the effects of quality of care, we're taking into consideration amount of time in care. And we're looking at the effects of type of care, we're taking into consideration both amount of care and quality of care. So we're really trying to tease apart these separate and separable features of the child care experience. Yes?
Can you just give a couple examples of indicators for
what? Of what?
Indicators for how you conceive of sensitive.
Sure. What's a sensitive, I mean, here's a prototypical example of sensitive versus insensitive mother. I've got myself a 9-month-old, right? He's sitting propped up in a seat, or she's sitting propped up in a seat, and I'm feeding him or her, right? How do I do that? Well, I can be reading my magazine and shoveling away, and the kid's sort of, you know, the stuff's dripping down his face, he's not swallowing, sort of, I'm missing his cues. Now, contrast that at the other extreme to a mother who's waiting for it, who takes it up, and then pauses and waits for the kid to open his mouth. He opens his mouth, in goes the shovel, out comes the spoon. Okay? Next round. Okay? All of a sudden I do the same thing, the kid turns away. Now an insensitive mother might do one of those, or might reach around and that. The sensitive mother pauses and waits. It's all about the timing. And think about it as, you know, I'd say two things. One, a little bit provocative. It's all about seeing the world from the child's point of view and saying, what does this kid want? What would make this kid feel, if not good, at least okay? And the fact of the matter is, the concept of sensitive mothering is just like the concept of sensitive lovemaking. You know, you can have your partner in mind and take their feelings into consideration before you do whatever you do, or you can just, you know, take care of yourself, basically. So really, sensitive mothering is about being decentered from the self and serving the other. So you have to see the world from the other's point of view and then act in accord with the world from the other point of view. Okay, but the thing is, it manifests itself in many different ways. And we can do anything, basically, with more or less sensitivity.